a Christian age in the scriptures and in early tradition, structured it according to a basic principle. The principle, of course, as we said, was the philosophical principle bequeathed by the ancient Greek philosophers, notably Aristotle and Plato. And consequently, all along the line, we will be making comparisons between grace and nature, or between the supernatural life and the natural one, on the assumption that there is a valid analogy. Before we go any further, I might just put in a good word for that analogy, because it can sometimes, if not scandalize, at least surprise people, the extent to which a person with, say, a basic text, take a single word like life, as found in the Bible, or virtue, or you name it, can seem to spin all kinds of ideas and conclusions. And a person is flabbergasted. Where do you get all of that from that one single word? Well, the secret, such as it is the principle of analogy. Namely that it is believed the Holy Spirit, in using human language to describe the mysteries of faith, had in mind some comparison between the natural and the supernatural order, the order of nature and the order of grace. And consequently, if he used a word like life, or if he used a word like body, or death, there must be something which this concept that God wanted to reveal through the terms life, body, and so on, something in that concept, naturally speaking, which can give us an idea of what he is talking about supernaturally. And therefore, while there are certain limits, obviously, beyond which the human mind analysis cannot go, nevertheless, to recognize that is to talk theology. Now, I have, for several years in teaching in the Divinity School, have had what we call fundamental theology as a course. The young men just coming into theology. And I keep telling them, the whole idea of comparison between the natural and the supernatural order, between nature and grace, is not a cliche, it's not a trick. It's the only key we have to an understanding of what Revelation is about. And that's what this is. The word grace, which means basically favor or gift, is analyzed. What kind of a gift is it? What sort of a favor is it? What's good about it? Now we said, I don't know how far we got. Did we begin all this already, the sharing of the divine nature? We did, I think. Please? Third effect. Well, I just mentioned the effects. We didn't analyze them yet. The first of those effects, we said, was the sharing of the divine nature, and I think we briefly expatiated on the subject. In any rate, we'll take them now in sequence and analyze, almost in some cases verbatim with St. Thomas. And I should say his analysis stands as far as Catholicism goes, and is still very much in possession. Much has happened in almost 700 years, and more than 700 years, St. Thomas wrote. Nevertheless, the basic ideas have remained. Now, there is, running through Scripture, the idea of somehow we being divinized. Somehow we are made divine. Who are born not of the will of flesh, nor the will of man, but of God. You are called the sons of God. And St. Paul, on at least two dramatic occasions, says that Christians are Christ, meaning, of course, that somehow we share with Christ in his divinity. The question is, what do we share? In one intelligible sense, may grace, habitual grace we're talking about, notice what we said habitual grace was. Habitual grace corresponds in the order of nature, using Greek philosophy, it corresponds in the order of nature to the principle of life, which is our soul, in its relation to the body. Habitual grace is that to the soul what the soul is to the human body. And the natural grace would be the operations, the various things which this soul does, here, of course, raised to a higher order of being than its physical, natural one. The word sharing, which sometimes is called participation, participating in the divine nature, has got to be understood. What does it mean to say that those who are justified somehow take on what God is? Well, the word sharing may be taken crudely in a quantitative sense, and I think we broke up on that subject last Friday. In a quantitative sense, I may be said to share something with someone when I've got a dollar and I split it in half, you know, somebody 50 cents and keep 50 for myself. In every quantitative sharing, the one who shares parts with something of what he's got, and he necessarily has less. That's the essence of quantitative sharing, because the essence of quantity is division or divisibility. You divide a thing, you make it in, you break it up into pieces. If something is real and it cannot be broken up into pieces, that's a spirit. That's not matter anymore. Material things, by definition, are divisible, can be cut up. You give a half or a part to somebody else and you've got less. Clearly, whatever it means to somehow share God's nature for those who are his friends, those who are justified, it cannot mean that God lets go of something of himself, as if we're giving us a part of God, say 0.1%, or you name it. It can't be that. It must be in the spiritual order, and here we have three ways we can look at it. Now, I'm presuming an awful lot when I try to syncopate a huge body of matter into a few sentences. And I assure you, whatever intelligibility you get out of this will be worthwhile, because this, as far as the essence goes, is pre-Reformation theology. There is one sense in which we can talk about, at least talk about, God's sharing with someone else, in the sense of considering some of the things that make God what he is, and that we, well, acquire some of that. Now, what are some of the things that make God what he is, make God God, make him divine? Well, first of all, he is the first cause of all things. He is the creator of everything outside of himself. He is, we say, a necessary being. Everything else except God need not exist. God must exist, not only to make everything else intelligible or possible, he just must be. There must be a God, period. And not merely to explain everything else than God. God cannot not be. Or again, he has infinite perfections. He is all powerful, all wise, all good. When we say that those who are friends of God who are justified have a share in the divine nature, do we mean that we have a share in that? The answer is no. For the simple reason that he'd cease to be God and, well, we would cease to be what we are. And if he could, as it were, partition or share with somebody his being a necessary being, well, he would thereby cease to be a necessary being. So clearly that is impossible. That kind of sharing is out. Secondly, there are other things which God has which are distinctive of him, such as his existence, and beyond that, his having a mind, having volition, having qualities of freedom in the exercise of his will, having the qualities of a spirit, He is not a mere body. In fact, he is not a body. Does God share those with his creatures? Yes, he does. Is that what we're talking about when we say sharing the divine nature in terms of this higher life called the life of grace, of righteousness, of friendship with God? No. Why not? Because other things or persons, and even less than human beings, even though not in the state of grace, in the state of God's friendship, also possess these things. Thus, the ordinary commentary, or commentaries on the passages in Genesis, or passage, the first one, where man is said to have been created into the image and likeness of God, that image and likeness is believed to be God's mind and will, his ability to think, and his capacity for free choice. Well, clearly, everyone who is human has that. Consequently, we say, and notice how we're using terms now, we say that is indeed sharing of the divine nature, but the sharing is something which is natural. Why? Because it pertains to the nature of the things that God made, of everything which is alive to have life, of whatever is rational to have rationality, and the rest. So at one extreme, it doesn't mean sharing in God's godness. Or secondly, it doesn't mean merely sharing in the things that God gave to beings to possess of and by themselves, and without which they wouldn't be what they are. Unless we had a mind, we wouldn't be rational. It must mean some third thing. And for want of a better word, the word supernaturally is used. Now it is here, this is the essence of really of Catholicism on its concept of grace. And this stands as a monolith. There are no deviations of any kind substantially as far as this concept goes. There are all kinds of schools of theology in the Catholic Church. You may surprise people who are not familiar with the science. All kinds of schools of theology. Theories on this, theories on that. But when it comes to the hardcore of certain principles, this is one. It just is completely uniform. What does it mean? Well, if we ask, what is it which belongs to God as God, and which only he has a right to, and yet which it is possible for him to communicate if he wants to? On analysis, we would say it is God's ability to know and love himself, as no one but God has a right to know and love. And the word right takes on a very special meaning here. Is the kind of a right that all of us have to know and love ourselves as nobody else can. And once you put it that way, it makes sense. Not only does nobody else have a right to, it's just impossible. I know myself, as you do yourselves individually, as no one, unless he became you, or someone else became I, could possibly know or love. Somewhat even almost identified with personality. Certainly it comes very close to the inner essence of the ego. Well, Catholicism believes, and Thomas is the one who developed the theology, that mysteriously and incredibly, except as an article of faith, God has communicated to creatures who clearly are not the Creator, who are not God, the capacity. Never, of course, the comprehensive capacity that would make from God, which would be a contradiction in terms, but a capacity for coming to know and love God in a way that only God knows and loves himself. Or to put it in modern existential psychological terms, as the ego can experience itself. I like to, at this point, further develop this because there's so much here, and of course the whole of the theology of grace expands in every direction, but just a few observations. To compare the amount that we know about ourselves, the knowledge, just in terms of quantity, nobody that we know better than ourselves. And strangely, it's not something merely which you might say we haven't read books about this. In fact, books would spoil it. Who would write a book about ourselves? Who would write a book about us? And what book could ever begin to adequately describe what's inside of us? Where do you start? The moment you begin to use language, you're handicapping yourself. You're putting a block between you and what you're saying. Now, one more item. It's the knowledge that we have of anything that gives us any joy or pleasure or relish in its possession. The degree to which I can experience the sweetness of, well, of ice cream, to that extent I enjoy it. If my taste buds are atrophied, maybe the sweetest thing going, I just don't know it. I must somehow be in contact with the reality for it somehow to affect me and to evoke pleasure even in bodily things. As we rise in the scale of being, there is a direct proportion between the experience that I have of the reality and the joy and pleasure that it gives me. And of course, the more there is to the thing to be known, the greater my capacity for loving it. As some people have told me, I stay up nights trying to find out what's lovable about him or her. You have to go into a huddle with yourself to find qualities that can evoke this kind of joy. Well, with ourselves, and this is a very simple comparison, there's nobody we love more than ourselves. And frankly, one reason is because we know so much about ourselves and have the uncanny ability, see, of concentrating on the good and of keeping away from the horizon of consciousness the evil, its positive genius. Now, where the object of knowledge is nothing less than infinite in its goodness, then we begin to, in a very weak, faltering way, begin to get some idea of what love and joy will be evoked by the soul that comes to know God as he is in himself. Anyhow, sharing the divine nature on this level therefore means sharing in the capacity for knowing and loving God as he knows and loves himself with the joy. Notice always, because joy is something distinctive, at least in our language, from knowledge and love. It is the effect of both. Secondly, the second effect of habitual or sanctifying grace, and this is repeated constantly, especially in the letters of Paul and in both the Gospel letters and Apocalypse of John, the two great writers on the divine adoption, or children of God, child of God, son of God, the relationship of fatherhood of God to our corresponding sonship. I always hesitate a moment when I speak to a female audience to use and keep hitting sonship because it's a generic term. I could use filiation, but that's lost on most people. pardon me, it wouldn't be on you, but it's a weak word. Running through the New Testament, therefore, is the repeated concept of those who are justified become sons of God. We are children of God. And Christ says, I'm not calling you servants, but friends. And more than once, we are told to call God our Father. And in fact, you might almost say this whole concept is summarized in the first two words of the Lord's Prayer, our Father. There's a relationship of the soul to God, which is a brand new relationship through the coming of Christ. The relationship of a parent to a child, and correspondingly of a child to its parents. But there's an adjective inserted there, and that is adopted, or as we say, adoptive sonship, or childhood of God. I should say, from the first thing that we've covered here, once we've said that sharing the divine nature, you will see there will be pretty much it will be trying to view the same concept from a different aspect each time. That first is the essence. The sharing of the divine nature is it. But the concept is so profound and beggars description that the other effects, though they are real effects, actually are not really exclusive, distinctive, actually exclusive or distinctive from the first, which is sharing the divine nature. So this divine adoption, becoming children of God, is looking at the idea of sharing of the divine nature from another viewpoint. First of all, it is well to note the two extremes, and Aquinas was particularly concerned about both, and in his writings, both in the Summa and elsewhere, he takes cognizance of two erroneous ideas that have crept into Christian thought on what it means to call us sons of God, as we are regularly in the Bible. People are called sons of God. The one extreme would be that of a man like Arius. Arius, remember, I think did we have some of this? Arius, A-R-I-U-S, was a priest of Constantinople who began to teach that Christ was not truly the Son of God, natural Son of God, but that he was only the greatest of God's creatures, and that therefore we are like he, that is, we are like Christ as the Son of God, but because he is only a creature, so we are only creatures. So for Arius, being a Son of God would mean being only like Christ was, and Christ was not God. And therefore, Arius would identify Christ's sonship of God with our sonship. And since we are not naturally sons of God, neither was Christ, or put otherwise. According to Arius, the kind of sonship that Christ had is the kind that we have. We are mere creatures. Christ was a mere creature. Well, that's not saying enough. Certainly it is not saying enough about Christ, and does not distinguish the sonship that Christ had and the sonship that we have. At the other extreme are those who really deified all human nature. Now they were, in Aquinas' time, mainly the Arabs. The Arab philosophers, remember that was almost 500, in fact, better than 500 years of Islamic philosophy. And there were quite a few men like Averroes, for example, who in their laudable effort to describe the nature of God and of man's relationship to God, had quite obscured, at least left obscure, the real distinction between a created and a divine nature. And consequently, Christians, especially in Spain, southern France, and also in Italy, were teaching that when we are spoken of as sons of God, What it means is that we are natural sons of God. That we have identically the same nature as God has, although we are mere creatures. As though God became incarnate in each one of us. Now, in one very unusual section of the Summa, Aquinas asks, would it have been possible for God to become a human being in the whole human race? What did you think, Jennifer?
But God can do all things.
Yes, he could have. God could have, and he answers in the affirmative, which is obvious. Yes, God could have, if he wanted to, have become a human being in each one of us, so that we would not be human beings, except having a human nature, but we would have a divine personality and would be just as literally as Christ, God, in human flesh. Possible. As a matter of fact, the Christian faith says it happened with only one human nature of Christ, where the divine nature and human were united in one divine person to form one individual who was God, having assumed human flesh. So it is not either. It is not reducing Christ to our stature, right, which is Arius, or raising us to Christ's stature, which is really a cosmic incarnation, and which was taught by at least some Christians and some so-called Christian mystics, who, as far as we can tell, had borrowed the idea from the Islamic philosophers. But what kind of filiation, what kind of sonship does a person who is justified, who with the language of Scripture becomes a son of God, and notice the word is becomes the son of God, what does that mean? There are three kinds of sonship, or three kinds of filiation. Three senses in which children of God are spoken of in the Bible. And Aquinas, in, by the way, 292, I pulled that out, is one section in Aquinas where you can read further on this point. There is one sense in which all rational creatures, all rational beings, so intelligent creation, is called, and that from the very beginning is called son, or they are called sons of God. Now why? Because we share with God that which makes him really a spiritual being having a mind and a will. The moment we've got a mind and a will, in that sense, we share something with God. And after we do come from God, don't we? Which all children do. It all depends on how much we have in common with him. See? All children have something in common with their parents, which makes them children of those parents. And the essence of being a child of anybody is to come from someone and to be like the one from whom you come. Those are the two parts. If you verify those two, you're a child of the one from whom you came, which is true of all biology and down to the lowest animal species up to the highest human creation. Therefore, in one and the lowest sense, since all rational creation has come from God, and it is like to God in having in common with him his spiritual nature, which, by the way, the irrational creation doesn't have, we therefore legitimately may be called children of God in a way that animals, trees, vegetation couldn't be called. Secondly, at the other extreme is Christ. And Aquinas keeps playing always. He's playing the floodlight, as it were, on the person of Christ and turns it to us. Because he is, and Christ's sonship, having his nature from the Father, is the paradigm, is the model, is the pattern of our own sonship. But his is not ours, and the kind that he has is not the kind that we have. His is called natural sonship. or natural filiation. Meaning what? Meaning that he has identically the same nature as his father. Just as, analogously speaking, a child born of a human parent or human parents will have identically the same nature. It will have a human nature. It will not be a horse, a dog, or something less. And correspondingly, a horse will not beget a man. You beget your kind. Now, where the kind that is begotten is of the same nature, it is called natural filiation. Christ, therefore, on his divine side, is a natural Son of God. We therefore have at one extreme the universal kind of sonship, which all rational creation shares. Why? Because it comes from God and is like God. See? Those are the two things that make a child. Coming from and being like to. See? Comes from and is like to. Now, everything came from God. From the lowest amoeba to the giants of human existence. But there are degrees and degrees and varieties of likeness too. Everything depends on this likeness too. If you have the minimal likeness too, namely a spiritual nature, which is mind and will, you have universal sonship, applicable all through the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament, to the angels, to human beings, to everybody. At the highest rung of sonship is where there is a likeness to, that is, simple identity. More than even likeness to, it's not just like to. The nature that Christ has as God is the self-same, identical, numerical nature that the Father has. Somewhere in between, we stand. And the term used is adopted sonship, or the sonship of those who are justified, the sonship of those who are friends of God, the sonship of the righteous. And we could go through a whole litany of terms, at least 20 terms, that are fairly synonymous, you see, to describe this kind of sonship. And when we say sonship, remember, we're always talking about somehow being like to, because it's assumed that everything came from God. So in that sense, we're all common. See? We've all proceeded from God, as every child proceeds from its parents. It's the degree of likeness to that determines the quality of the being a child of God. Now, what kind of quality do we have which allows us to be called in a very special sense children of God, and not merely in the generic sense as all creation, yet not also in the sense in which Christ, who had the same identical nature, has his Father? Well, we've just described this parenthood and filiation. I suppose you know filiation comes from the Latin word filius, which means son. Filiation is merely the abstract term for becoming, and it's a nice term because it covers both. Filius is masculine and filia is feminine. Filiation is nice, generic. We just don't have it in English. I suppose theologians, mostly being men, they insisted on using a term that is normally masculine. Parenthood and filiation, therefore, are related as cause and effect. And where the effect means proceeding from and like to, then you've got filiation. Now, the kind of filiation that we have, which is that of the justified, or the righteous, the friends of God, those whom St. John says are not born of the will of flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. Or in John's terms, we are the sons of God. The term that has been developed by theology based on St. Paul is adopted sonship. Now, theology finds four essential elements in a child that he is said to be adopted, which it applies through our unique kind of relationship to God as being his adopted children. Way beyond the legal adoption that we're familiar with from human experience, and yet below the natural sonship that Christ, as the Son of God, enjoyed. There is first, in adoption, a free, and in that sense gratuitous, acceptance of another person. The first is the gratuitous. Now this gratuitous, always keep in mind, I don't want to stress certain things that I want you not to forget. Remember the word gratuitous comes from the same, it's the same word as our English gratis, which after all is just a borrowing from the Latin, which means free. But it's not only free, it's also gracious, because the Latin, see, for grace is gratia. So it is, it's a gift. It's free in the sense that you don't have to do it and you get, you're not looking for anything in return. You are seeking to give and not to get. See? Let's savor that for a moment. The essence of gratuity, and we just come back to the same concept of grace. We're just analyzing, that's what theology is. See? Analyzes a single concept, just burrows down, 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 as far as the mind can go. Sonship, or adoption, which is what we're familiar with from human experience, where it is adopted, means that there is a favor exercised towards the person who is adopted. It is gratuitous. It is not something which the parent has to accept or do. You see, the parent has a positive God-given duty as far as her or his child is concerned. See? No question of adopting your own flesh and blood. It's a duty. It's justice. It's an obligation. There's nothing gratuitous about it. You can't take it or leave it. Or if you leave it, you're being unjust. So it's gratuitous in the sense of being free, and secondly, as we saw when we analyzed the concept of grace, it means that there is nothing sought for oneself by the one who adopts, but the purpose is to give. And what happens? It is the acceptance, gratuitous acceptance of another person. Now, the other person is other in the sense that he has... he's just a different individual. He has not come from the one who adopts. Now, say, a natural relationship between father and, say, son is involved. So it is another person, meaning it's a stranger. Someone who has no claims on the love or affection of the one adopting. And thirdly, into sonship. So what happens is that a person takes a stranger in and accepts him and treats him as a son. And finally, with the right of inheritance. Now this is St. Paul, over and over again, especially in Romans. In other words, here is a stranger being adopted into the divine family. And remember, it is a family, because God is a family. In other words, he has a natural son. And there are three to God, to make up God. Here's a stranger adopted into the divine family and given the rights. And of course, here's where the contradiction apparently comes in. Right and gratuitous. Through God's gracious love or mercy, someone who is a stranger, who is not God, stranger in the sense that he is not God, who is a creature, he is given a right, which baffles the imagination, because God then gives the person who is so justified a claim of that which God alone has a natural right to enjoy. And then we come back to what we saw before, and the right, of course, is sharing in the knowledge and love of God and the corresponding joy that follows on that possession. And Marcia, I see you have your hand up, which means I'm sure it's time to take a test. We find out and decide that it cannot be that we are children of God in the sense in which Christ was the Son of God, as a natural son is related to his father, having the same nature. It could be only adopted. When we analyze the concept of adoption from human relationship, we find that among its elements is this fourth one, which means that the child who is adopted, if it's a true adoption, is not only accepted as a member of the family, but is given the right to inherit what belongs to the family by right. Now, as St. Paul says, the inheritance, of course, is that which Christ had by nature, we by grace. Christ, being the natural Son of God, had a natural right to what? To the possession of this. See? To knowing and loving God as God knows and loves himself. In other words, to the possession of heaven. Now, this is a strange term to say, yet it's absolutely correct. It is the soundest theology. The only one who has a natural right to heaven is God. See? That's the inheritance. That belongs to the Trinity alone. In fact, that is the Trinity. The Trinity is where heaven is, or where heaven is, there must be the Trinity. And consequently, where the Trinity or the three persons have a right to that which constitutes, you might say, their nature, the right to know and love themselves, they don't have. Who doesn't? Yet those who are, as it were, and not as it were, who are made children of the family of God, see, we're using terms that are very common, but the meaning is way beyond the common. What we are saying is, when a child in ordinary human relationships is adopted by a family, well, if it's a true legal adoption, it has a right to inherit what belongs to that family. Now, what normally belongs to that family are the possessions of that family, the real estate, the investments, and so on. You don't call it real adoption, real, complete adoption, unless the child shares in the rights that a natural child would have. Well, Paul takes that whole concept and raises it to this level of grace. And he explains, see, what he's explaining is the fact that our right, quotation marks, to heaven is a right that has come to us through God's favor in adopting us into his family. It is something to which only God himself has a natural right. Or if you will, the Son of God, who is Christ, has a natural right. And it is in this sense, now this goes in many directions. This is a whole theology by itself. This section here, see, is a semester course. So we can't begin to say all that needs to be said. But it is in this sense that we are said, and St. Paul speaks of us as being the brothers of Christ. You might see in human language, half-brothers. How do you want to put it? And therefore we are, as Paul says, co-heirs with him. He having a right to the inheritance, naturally, as a child would have, to that which belongs to the Father. What belongs to the Father? That which, in terms of God, there's no question of having real estate or big estates or rambling ranches, see, 2,500 acres. You're using human language to make sense of a mystery. See? What belongs to God and is by nature. Self-knowledge and the love of himself of his infinite attributes, which is the basis for infinite joy. All joy ultimately comes from loving what you know. Where the one who is loved is the infinite God, the capacity for joy is correspondingly infinite. Well, right to inherit of inheritance therefore means the right by grace, which means by favor, which means as a gift, which means we had no right to it naturally, in a way in which Christ, who is the natural Son of God, did have naturally.
I know you have not used the phrase unmerited favor.
Remember what we're doing. We're just re-ringing the changes, as it were, on that one single big concept of sharing the divine nature. Thirdly, and this, of course, we have especially the famous words of Jesus at the Last Supper, "I have called you not servants, but friends." And again, in that same context of Christ's describing a relationship between those who are justified, between himself and them, as one of the dearest and closest friendships. It is well to know, and this is part of our language, you know, books have been written on the philosophy of the English language, especially the American language, and it's not a flattering philosophy. Pardon the interlude here, it may help to see what we're stuck with our English language. We have, I don't know, but with implications that we'd have to have about 6 or 7 English words stuck together, and by that time you just lose the savor of it. Anyhow, negatively, in the language of Scripture, a divine friend or friend of God is one who has had his sins removed. Because in the language of Revelation, there is only one real obstacle to friendship with God, and that is sin. And consequently, in the degree to which that is removed, to that extent a person is said to be a friend of God. And God is correspondingly said to love him. So negatively, it is the absence or the removal of sin. And justification, which is the process by which a person becomes a friend of God, is somehow the removal of sin. And even in one of the most extreme forms of those who would not say there is any infusion of grace through justification, even then, you still have the idea of at least being somehow remotely considered a friend. Right? Because somehow the sins are at least obscured, or here, of course, removed, but positively, and that's what we're after. Positively, friendship means or stands for all the manifestations of God's love which only those who are justified enjoy. It doesn't mean that only they are the objects of God's love. No. There is a sense in which anyone who exists is at least to that extent the object of God's love. Because if God didn't love the person, he would cut him off. Nevertheless, there is a sense in which those who are justified are said to be friends of God. St. John, especially in his epistles, particularly the first one, speaks a great deal about, which means it is some kind of relationship with God that is unique. Now, what is it? We have seen the substance of this when we analyzed, in a previous context, the nature of loving God. Remember when our analysis, we did have this, didn't we, in this class? The various ways in which God is, can be loved with self-interest, with disinterested love, and so on. Well, remember, here it is, God's loving us now, which is being considered. And consequently, there are at least three main features which summarizes what we had seen before. Only here, the stress is not on our loving God, although that is one of the effects of it, but on God's loving us. It is what Jesus meant when he said, "I have called you not servants, but friends." The three elements that are crucial are, first, in any true friendship that we're taking, the English, or you might say the human concept of friendship, and analyzing and see how it applies to God in favor of those who are justified or righteous. There is first a mutuality. In other words, it must be on both sides. Therefore, those who are befriended of God both love him and he loves them. And really, both in a way cause the other. So that if a person doesn't love God, God won't love him. And if God does not love a person, that person won't love God. So there is a mutuality. Secondly, it is some kind of manifest mutual relationship. God does something. He shows his love for those with whom he has the relationship of friendship. And again, we just hark back to what we saw before. All kinds of ways. Now, what he does, is spelled out in this benevolence. But this being manifest, there are all kinds of ways in which friends show their love for one another. And even in human relationship, anytime two friends stop showing their mutual love, their friendship begins to cool and pretty soon it disappears. There must be a mutual manifestation of that love. First it becomes suspect and then it is known. And we, because why? Because the drive to give, is so strong between persons who really love one another. You never go wrong if for too long there is the absence of manifestation of love. You not only suspect that you can deny the love. It's not there. It must somehow be shown. Because if it isn't shown, the drive, which is the strongest drive in even in God, let alone in human beings, is to communicate, to somehow help, to benefit, to show that you love the one whom you really love. Then, of course, benevolence is that which is shown. And benevolence in itself, again, just to break up the Latin word from which the word benevolence is derived, benevolence I wish well. I wish volo well. And it's more than wish. I will. I want to benefit the one whom I love. Let's pause here for just a moment. The idea of benevolence, now again, this goes into all directions, and what we said before regarding genuine love, benevolence, the effort made to prove that you love a person if you really love him. But the very fact that I want or I will to benefit, that's another way of spelling out benevolence. I want to benefit. That's exactly what it means. I want to benefit whom? The one whom I love. That's benevolence. Now immediately, the moment you say I want to benefit, the whole shift, by essence, is from the person who is benefiting to the one who is benefited. In other words, the whole idea of charity, which this is, in terms of friendship, is that my unique concern when I love someone, when I am benevolent towards him, is not, do I owe the person something? Does he have a claim on me? Do I get something out of it? The only question, the unique question is, can I benefit? It's not whether I have to, whether I should, whether I get anything out of it, whether there's any reason why I should as far as a claim goes. No. There's only one question. Will it do the person whom I love any good? It's the only question that love asks. And that is behind this concept of divine friendship. So that what we are saying in essence is God, as it were, asks himself, will that which I am thinking of giving those with whom I am in the relationship of friendship as the justified, will it benefit them? What's good for them? Now, in answer to that, what is good for them? What can I do for them? Begin hard back, see, to the ultimate, see, to the extreme. God, as it were, asks himself, what is the greatest, the most, that I can share with those whom I love and with whom I have this relationship of friendship? Well, the last analysis, and this known even from human love, the greatest and best thing that I can share with one whom I love is myself. My own nature. And the very act of marriage, and the best writing in Christian literature, for example, on marriage, on our marital intercourse, is to speak of it as symbolic, is externally expressive, see, of the desire to give as far as it is physically possible to give. See? But notice, that desire to give is inside, see, of which even the marital union is only, albeit a very expressive, symbol or sign. And where the symbol is there, and it lacks the love inside which it is to symbolize, it will even be repudiated. You don't want the hulk, the husks. You want the reality. That's why mutual love, see, between husband and wife, is so important. And it is also the reason why, running through the New Testament, and Christ more than once speaks of the, uses the marriage feast as a parable, see, for the relationship between God and the soul. This, of course, goes into all the symbolism of mysticism, which it is not our purpose to go into. But you at least get a savor. Some of you, I'm sure, have had more than a smattering of this, but at least to synthesize it in terms of the theology of habitual grace here on the level of divine friendship. Fourthly, righteousness or justice. Now, what we're doing again, we're taking the same concept, the same basic idea of sharing the divine nature and seeing it from still another angle. This angle happens to be the one that most people are most familiar with, by at least verbally, because the term righteous is regularly used, more frequently in Protestant writings. On the other hand, now even the Catholic scriptures, by the way, are using the word righteous. And as you probably know, there has been a common Bible, scripture readings, which have been translated, the New Testament certainly, which is being used in England for both Protestants and Catholics, a common Bible. It may, in time, for the next 5 years, be adopted in the United States. And I'm happy to say that I have something to do with the beginnings of that work. And the word righteousness, therefore, is something which both the Protestants have regularly used and Catholics have adopted. The more familiar term in Catholic circles is justice, where the word justified corresponds, you see, to righteous. They are really the same. Now, what's behind it? Somehow we will come back to our first idea that we talked about before, but here from a different angle. Here the angle, if we may so speak of it, is a dynamic thing. So far in these first three levels, as profound as they are, we have nevertheless been describing the relationship of God to the human soul that is in the state of his friendship, in his grace, in, you might say, not a static condition exactly, but, well, as it is, without describing of what's going on in the soul. Well, it's not merely a question of sharing the divine nature or being an adopted child of God. or even being just a friend of God, something is happening to the one who is in this state. And the very word state is a little misleading because it seems to be correlated with static. See? And being in the friendship of God is anything but static. It's dynamism of the highest order. In other words, there's something going on in the soul. What's going on? In a single sentence, the soul is going to its destiny. And this goingness in the direction of its destiny is its righteousness. It is going in the right direction. It is going in that direction to which it has been predestinated by God and where it will find its ultimate fulfillment. Now, this again, just a whole panorama. Once we've said that, then when we look into the human being in the state of righteousness, we ask, well, now what does it mean concretely? It means concretely that all of the actions, everything which a person does who is in the state of God's friendship, is a movement towards where it's going, where it's supposed to be going. And the essence of unrighteousness is going in the opposite direction. It is well to just look at this for a moment. Etymology is not just a pastime, by the way. There's a whole philosophy, as I'm sure you know, built on the analysis of words. And provided you know what concepts are behind the words, it's a very valid philosophy. But the very word direction RECT, which of course in its Latin endings is rectus, recta, rectum, which means right. It means correct. It means that there is, well, what we call direction, see? It means that it's going somewhere. In fact, it's going to where it's supposed to be going. So the very word direction is basically the same concept linguistically as righteousness. I just want to have you see what we're talking about, see? There is both a movement, there is both a dynamism. It's not just that we are in God's friendship. Something is happening to us. Or better, we are doing something. What are we doing? We're going somewhere. Where are we going? We're going to God. Now, the beauty behind this concept is, and this is validly pointed out by Thomas, for example, from the writings, especially of John, Paul too.